Any fridge, all stacked to the sides, not much more than another 20 feet to run, and behind me I could hear more of the junk pile collapsing in front of the door, but that didn't help much. They'd be through that in a few seconds.
"Just shoot that way! She's gotta be that way!"
Crystal saying, and Deandra shushing her, their feet heavy on the last stairs, taking their time. Deandra kicking things out of the way as they moved toward the door, closing me off like I was a rabid animal that needed to be put down. Deandra not even all that focused, saying suddenly, "That pot roast was too salty." Inside my little room, I noticed the faintest light in the corner, coming from somewhere in the ceiling. I pushed toward it, stumbling over a red wagon, the women laughing when they heard me fall. Crystal yelling, "Now you're gonna have a bruise!" Deandra knocking things away, and I was underneath the light. It was the opening of a wind turbine, the ventilation shaft for the tornado shelter, and it was too small for most people to fit, but not me. And I started piling things to reach it, to get my fingers to the top so I could pull myself up, and Deandra and Crystal were almost past the debris. I tried to stand on an old baby buggy, but the bottom gave out. I ripped up my leg, started stacking things, a warped diaper table, and then some encyclopedias, and me on top of the encyclopedias, feeling them want to slide away, but I got my arms up through the shaft, breaking through the slats of the rusty turbine. One big push, and I was breathing the cold night air, ready for the next push to get me all the way out, and then Crystal was grabbing my foot, trying to pull me back down, me kicking her, scrambling. Screams beneath me, "Shoot her!" And Crystal screaming, "I got her!" And her weight pulling me down, me losing leverage, half in and out of the ground. And then I gave one good kick with my bad foot and jabbed my heel right in her face. The nose going, a wolf wail beneath me, and Deandra yelling, "Oh, baby!" And me free, back up, my arms bearing deep red scratches from the top of the shaft, but up, over and onto the ground, and as I was heaving for air, breathing in the mud, I could already hear Deandra going, "Get up top! Get up top!" My car keys were gone, lost somewhere inside, and so I turned and ran for the woods, a limping trot like something with three legs, one sock on, one sock off, mucking through the mud, stinking of manure in the moonlight. And then I turned, feeling almost good, and saw they were out of the house. They were behind me, running after me, white, pale faces, each leaking blood. But I made it to the forest. My head was whirling, my eyes unable to hold on to anything, a tree, the sky, a rabbit spooking away from me. "Libby!" behind me. I went deeper into the woods, about ready to pass out, and as my eyes started going dark, I found a gargantuan oak. It was balanced on a 4-foot drop-off, gnarled roots radiating out like the sun, and I climbed down in the dirt and burrowed my way into an old animal den, under one of those roots as thick as a grown man. I dug into the cold, wet ground, a little thing in a little hollow, shivering but silent, hiding, which was something I could do. The flashlights came closer, hitting the tree trunk, the women clambering over me, a flash of skirt, a glimpse of one red freckled leg.
"She has to be here. She can't have gone that far."
And me trying not to breathe, knowing if I did it would be a gulp of air that would get me shot in the face. And so I held my breath as I felt their weight nudge the tree roots. And Crystal said,
"Could she have gone back to the house?"
And Deandra said, "Keep looking. She's quick." Like someone who knew. And they turned and ran deeper into the woods, and I breathed into the ground, swallowed earthy air, my face muffled against the dirt. For hours, the woods echoed with their screams of outrage, frustration.
"This is not good! This is very bad!"
And at some point, the screaming stopped. And then I waited more hours, till dawn, before I pulled myself out and hobbled through the trees toward home.
Ben Day, January 3, 1985, 2:12 a.m. Deandra was still perched on Michelle's body, listening. Ben sat in a bundle, rocking himself, while from the hallway came sounds of screaming and cursing, the axe hitting flesh, the shotgun and silence, and then his mom going again, not hurt, maybe not hurt. But then he knew she was. She was making gibberish sounds. And
ee.
And she was banging into the walls. And those heavy boots came walking down the hall toward his mom's room. And then the horrible sound of small hands trying to gain purchase, Debbie's hand scraping along the wooden floor, and then the axe again, and a loud release of air. And then came another shotgun blast, Deandra flinching on top of Michelle. Deandra's nerves showed only in her hair, which twittered around her head in those thick curls. Otherwise, she didn't move. The steps paused outside the door Ben had shut after the screaming began, the door he was hiding behind while his family lay outside, dying. They heard a wail.
God damn it!
And then the steps ran, heavy and hard, out of the house. Ben whispered across to Deandra, pointing at Michelle.
Is she okay?
And Deandra frowned like he'd insulted her.
No, she's dead.
Ben couldn't stand up.
Are you sure?
I'm totally sure, Deandra said, and unstraddled her, Michelle's head lolling to the side, her open eyes on Ben.
Her broken glasses lay next to her. Deandra walked over to Ben, her knees in front of his face. She held out a hand to him.
Come on, get up.
They opened the door, Deandra's eyes widening like she was looking at a first snow. Blood was everywhere. Debbie and his mom in a pool of it. The axe and shotgun dropped along the hallway, a knife farther down. Deandra walked over to look more closely, her reflection dark in the pond of blood that was still flowing toward him.
Holy shit, she whispered. Maybe we really did fuck with the devil.
Ben ran to the kitchen, wanting to vomit in the sink, the heaving feeling comforting. Get it up, get it all up, the way his mom used to say, holding his forehead over the toilet when he was a kid. Get all that bad stuff out. But nothing happened, so he staggered toward the phone, and there was Deandra stopping him.
You going to tell on me? For Michelle? We need to call the police, he said,
his eye on his mom's stained coffee cup, some Folgers still at the bottom.
Where's the little one? Deandra asked. Where's the baby? Oh, shit! Libby!
He ran back down the hallway, trying not to look at the bodies, pretending they were just obstacles to jump over. And he looked inside his mom's room and felt the chill, saw the breeze fluttering the curtains and the open window. He came back to the kitchen.
She's gone, he said. She made it out. She's gone. Well, go bring her back.
Ben turned to the door, about to run outside, and then stopped.
Bring her back? Why?
Deandra crossed to him, took his hands and put them on her belly.
Ben, do you not see how all this was meant to be? You think it's coincidence that we do the ritual tonight, that we need money, and that, pow, a man kills your family? You will inherit everything for your mom's life insurance now. Whatever you want to do. You want to go live in California, on the beach, go live in Florida? We can do it.
Ben had never said he wanted to live in California or Florida. Deandra had said that.
We are a family now. We can be a real family. But Libby is a problem. If she saw something, what if she didn't?
But Deandra was already shaking her head, no.
Clean break, baby. It's too dangerous. Time to be brave. But if we need to get out of town tonight, I can't wait around for the life insurance. Well, of course we can't leave tonight. Now we need to stay. It would look suspicious if you left. But you see what a gift this is? People are going to forget all about the Chrissy Cates bullshit because you're the victim now. People want to be good to you. I'll try to hide this.
She fingered her belly.
for another month somehow. I'll wear a coat all the time or something. And then we get the money, and we fucking fly. Free. You'll never have to eat shit again. What about Michelle?
I got her diary, Deandra said, showing him the new journal with the Minnie Mouse cover.
We're cool.
But what do we say about Michelle?
You say the crazy man did it, like the rest. Like Libby, too.
But what about... And Ben, you can never say that you know me. Not till we leave. I can't be linked to this in any way, do you understand? You want me to give birth to our baby in prison? You know what happens then. It goes into foster care, and you will never see it again. You want that for your baby? For the mother of your child? You still have a chance to be a big boy here. Be a man. Now go get me Libby.
He took the big utility flashlight and went out into the cold calling Libby's name. She was a quick kid, a good runner. She could have made it all the way down their road and toward the highway by now. Or she could be hiding in her usual place down by the pond. He crunched through the snow, wondering if this was all a bad trip. He'd go back to the house, and it would be just like it was earlier, when he heard the snick of the lock, and everything was normal. Everyone asleep, a regular night. Then he saw Deandra crouched on top of Michelle like some giant predator bird, them both shaking in the dark, and he knew nothing was going to be okay, and he also knew he wasn't going to bring Libby back to the house. He brushed his flashlight over the tops of the reeds and saw a flash of her red hair amidst the bland yellow, and he yelled, "Libby, stay where you are, sweetheart," and turned and ran back to the house. Deandra was chopping the walls, chopping the couch, screaming with her teeth bared. She'd smeared the walls with blood. She'd written things. She'd tracked blood in her men's shoes all over. She'd eaten Rice Krispies in the kitchen and left trails of food behind her. And she was leaving fingerprints everywhere. And she kept yelling, "Make it look good! Make it look real good!" But Ben knew what it was. It was the bloodlust. The same feeling he got. That flare of rage and power that made you feel so strong. He cleaned up the footprints pretty good, he thought, although it was hard to tell which were Deandra's and which were the man's. Who the fuck was the man? He wiped everything she'd touched. The light switches, the axe, the counters, everything in his room. Deandra appearing in the doorway, telling him, "I wiped down Michelle's neck." Ben trying not to think. Don't think. He left the words on the walls, didn't know how to fix that. She'd gotten at his mother with the axe. His mom had strange new gashes, deep, and he wondered how he could be so calm, and when his bones would melt and he'd collapse. And he told himself to pull it fucking together. Be a fucking man. Do it. Be a man. Do what needs to be done. Be a man. And he ushered Deandra out of the house, and the whole place already smelled like earth and death. When he closed his eyes, he saw a red sun, and he thought again, annihilation.
Libby Day, now. I was going to lose toes again. I sat outside a closed gas station for almost an hour, rubbing my ringing feet, waiting for Lyle. Every time a car went by, I ducked behind the building in case it was Crystal and Deandra out searching for me. If they found me now, I couldn't run. They'd have me, and it'd be done. I'd wanted to die for years, but not lately, and definitely not by those bitches. I had called Lyle Collect from a phone outside the gas station I was sure wouldn't work, and he'd started the conversation before the operator even got off the line. "Did you hear? Did you hear?" "I did not hear. I don't want to hear. Just come get me." I hung up before he started in with his questions. "What happened?" Lyle said when he finally pulled up, me in full bone chatter, the air frosted. I threw myself in the car, my arms in a mummy wrap from the cold. "Deandra's definitely not fucking dead. Take me home. I need to get home."
"You need to get to a hospital. Your face is... it's... have you seen your face?"
He pulled me under the dome light of his car to take a closer look. I've felt my face. Or the police department. What happened? I knew I should have gone with you. Libby. Libby, what happened? I told him. The whole thing. Letting him sort it out between my crying jags, ending with, "And then they tried to kill me." The words coming out like hurt feelings. A little girl telling her mom that someone was mean to her.
"So Deandra killed Michelle," Lyle said. "We're going to the cops."
"No, we're not. I just need to go home."
My words were curdled with snot and tears.
"We've got to go to the cops, Libby."
I started screaming, nasty things, slamming my hand on the window, yelling till spittle ran out my mouth, and that only made Lyle more sure he was taking me to the police.
"You'll want to go to the police, Libby. When I tell you what I need to tell you, on top of this, you'll want to go to the police."
I knew that's what I needed to do. But my brain was infected with memories of what happened after my family was murdered. The long, washed-out hours going over and over my story with the police, my legs hanging off oversized chairs, cold hot chocolate in styrofoam cups, me unable to get warm, just wanting to go to sleep. That total exhaustion, where even your face is numb. And you can say all you want. It doesn't matter. Because everyone's dead anyway. Lyle turned the heater on full blast, aimed every vent at me.
"Okay, Libby, I have some news. I think, well, okay, I'll just say it, okay?"
"You're freaking me out, Lyle. Just say it." The dome light didn't cast enough glow. I kept looking around the parking lot to make sure no one was coming.
"Remember the Angel of Debt?"
Lyle began.
"That the Kill Club was investigating? He's been caught in a suburb of Chicago. He got nailed in the middle of helping some poor stock market sucker stage his death. It was supposed to look like a horse riding accident. The Angel got caught on one of the riding trails, going at the guy with a rock, bashing his head in. His name is Calvin Deal. Used to be a farmer."
"Okay," I said, but I knew more was coming.
"Okay, so it turns out he's been helping to kill people since the 80s. He was smart. He has handwritten notes from everyone he murdered. 32 people, swearing they hired him."
"Okay."
"One of those notes was from your mother."
I bent over at the waist, but kept looking at Lyle.
"She hired him to kill her, but it was supposed to be just her, to get the life insurance, save the farm, save you guys, Ben. They have the note."
"So, what? No, that doesn't make sense. Deandra killed Michelle. She had her diary. We just said it was Deandra."
"Well, that's just the thing. This Calvin Deal's playing himself off like a folk hero. I swear, there's been a crowd outside the jail the past few days. People with signs like, 'Deal's the real deal.' They'll be writing songs about him soon. Helping people in debt die so the banks won't get their property. Screwing over the insurance companies to boot. People are eating it up. But, he's saying he won't confess to murder on any of the 32 people. Says they were all assisted suicide. Die with dignity. But he's taking the rap for Debbie. He says he'll confess to Debbie. Says she wandered in, got in the middle, things went bad. He says that's the only one he's sorry for."
"What about Michelle?"
"He says he never even saw Michelle. I can't think why he'd lie."
"Two killers," I said. "Two killers the same night. That would be our luck." Somewhere between the time I was hiding in the woods, then whimpering at the gas station, then bawling in Lyle's car, and finally convincing a sleepy local sheriff's deputy I wasn't crazy, "You're whose sister?" I wasted 7 hours. Deandra and Crystal were clean gone by the morning, and I mean clean. They'd doused the place with gas, and it had burnt to the ground before the fire trucks even got out of the station. I told my story a lot more times, the story taken with a mix of bemusement and doubt, and then finally a dash of credence.
"We'll need just a little more, you know, to link her to your sister's murder," one detective said, pressing a styrofoam cup of cold coffee in my hand.
2 days later, detectives appeared on my doorstep. They had photocopies of letters from my mom. Wanted to see if I recognized her handwriting. Wanted to see if I wanted to see them. The first was a very simple, one-page note, absolving Calvin Deal of her murder. The second was to us. Dear Ben, Michelle, Debbie, and Libby, I don't think this letter will ever reach you, but Mr. Deal said he'd hold it for me, and I guess that gives me some comfort. I don't know. Your grandparents always told me, make a useful life. I don't feel I've really done that, but I can make a useful death. I hope you all forgive me. Ben, whatever happens, don't blame yourself. Things got beyond our control, and this is what needed to be done. It seems very clear to me. I'm proud, in a way. My life has been determined so much by accidents. It seems nice that now an accident on purpose will make things right again. A happy accident. Take good care of each other. I know Diane will do right by you. I'm only sad I won't get to see what good people you become, although I don't need to. That's how sure I am of my kids. Love you. Mom. I felt hollowed out. My mom's death was not useful. I felt a shot of rage at her, and then imagined those last bloody moments in the house, when she realized it had gone wrong, when Debbie lay dying, and it was all over, her unsterling life. My anger gave way to a strange tenderness, what a mother might feel for her child, and I thought, at least she tried. She tried on that final day, as hard as anyone could have tried. And I would try to find peace in that.
Calvin Deal, January 3rd, 1985, 4:12 a.m. It was stupid how wrong it had gone so quickly. And here he'd been doing her a favor, the redhead farm girl. God damn, she didn't even leave him enough money. They agreed on $2,000. She left an envelope with only $812.75. It was petty and small and stupid the whole night. It was disastrous. He'd gotten lax, cocky, indulgent, and it had led to... She'd have been so easy, too. Most people were picky about how they died, but all she asked was not to drown. She didn't want to drown, please. He could have done it so many simple ways, like he'd always done. But then he'd gone to get a drink at the bar, no big deal. Truckers went through here all the time. He never stood out. But her husband was there, and he was such a piece of shit peckerhead, such a little worthless rat man, that Calvin found himself listening pretty hard for what this runner guy's deal was, and people were telling all sorts of stories about how the man had ruined the farm, ruined his family, was in debt up to his shirt collar. And Calvin Deal, a man of honor, had thought, why not? Stab the woman through the heart on her doorstep. Make this runner guy sweat some. Let the cops question him, this sorry shit who took no responsibility. Make him take some. Ultimately, it'd be written off as a random crime, as believable as the other stuff he'd pulled, car crashes and hopper collapses. Down near Ark City, he drowned a man in his own wheat, rigged it to look like a turnover. Calvin's killings always worked with the seasons, drowning during spring floods, hunting accidents during autumn. January was the season for house robberies and violence. Christmas was over, and the new year just reminded you of how little your life had changed, And man, people got angry in January. So stab her through the heart. Fast. A big Bowie hunting knife. Be over in 30 seconds. And the pain wasn't bad at all, people said. Too much shock. She dies, and it's the sister that finds her. She'd made sure her sister was coming over early. She was a thoughtful lady that way. Calvin needed to get back to his house, back over the Nebraska border, and clean his hair. He'd wipe himself down with chunks of snow. His head was smoking from the cold, but it was still sticky. He wasn't supposed to get blood on him, and he needed it out. He could smell it in the car. He pulled over to the side of the road, his hands sweating inside his gloves. He thought he saw a child, running in the snow up ahead, but realized he was just seeing the little girl he'd killed. Pudgy thing. Her hair all still in braids, running, and him panicked, seeing her not as a little girl, not yet, but as prey, something that needed putting down. He didn't want to do it, but no one got to see his face. He had to protect himself first, and he had to get her before she woke the other kids up. He knew there were more, and he knew he didn't have the heart to kill all of them. That wasn't his mission. His mission was to help. He saw the little girl turn to run, and he got that axe suddenly in his hand. He saw the shotgun, too, and he thought, the axe is more quiet. I can still keep this quiet. And then, maybe he did go insane. He was so angry at the child. He chopped up a little girl. So angry at the redhead woman, for screwing this all up, for not dying right. He killed a little girl with an axe. He shot off the head of a mother of four instead of giving her the death she deserved. Her last moments were horror, nightmare in her house, instead of him just holding her while she bled onto the snow and died with her face against his chest. He chopped up a little girl. For the first time, Calvin Deal thought of himself as a murderer. He fell back in his seat and bellowed.
Libby Day, now. 13 days after Deandra and Crystal went missing, and the police had still not found them, had still not found any physical evidence to link Deandra to Michelle. The hunt was dissolving into an arson case. It was losing steam. Lyle came over to watch bad TV with me, his new habit. I let him come if he didn't talk too much. I made a big deal about him not talking too much. But I missed him on the days he didn't come. We were watching some particularly grotesque reality show when Lyle suddenly sat up straighter. "Hey, that's my sweater." I was wearing one of his too-tight pullovers I'd taken from the back of his car at some point, and it really did look much better on me. "It really does look better on me," I said. "Man, Libby, you could just ask, you know." He turned back to the TV, where women were going at each other like angry pound dogs. "Libby's sticky fingers. Too bad you didn't leave Deandra's with, like, her hairbrush. We'd have some DNA." "Ah, the magic, magic DNA," I said. I'd stopped believing in DNA. On the TV, a blonde woman had another blonde woman by the hair and was pushing her down some steps, and I flipped the channel to a nature show on crocodiles. "Oh. Oh, my God!" I ran from the room. I came back, slapped Deandra's lipstick and thermometer on the table. "Lyle Wirth, you are goddamn brilliant," I said, and then I hugged him. "Well," he said, and then laughed. "Wow. Huh, brilliant. Libby Sticky Fingers thinks I'm brilliant." "Absolutely." DNA from both objects matched the blood on Michelle's bedspread. The manhunt ignited. No wonder Deandra had been so insistent she was never remotely connected to Ben. All those scientific advances, one after another, making it easier and easier to match DNA. She must have felt more endangered each year instead of less. Good. They nailed Deandra at a money order dive in Amarillo. Crystal was nowhere to be found, but Deandra was nabbed, although it took four cops to get her in the car. So Deandra was in jail, and Calvin Deal had confessed. Even some skeevy loan agent had been rounded up, his mere name giving me the willies. Len. With all that, you'd think Ben might have been released from prison, but things don't go that quickly. Deandra wasn't confessing, and until her trial unfolded, they were going to hold on to my brother, who refused to implicate her. I finally went to visit him at the end of May. He looked plumper, weary. He smiled weakly at me as I sat down. "Wasn't sure if you'd want to see me," I said.
Deandra was always sure you'd find her out. She was always sure of it. Guess she was right.
Guess she was. Neither of us seemed willing to go past that. Ben had protected Deandra for almost 25 years. I had undone all that. He seemed chagrined, but not sad. Maybe he'd always hoped she'd be exposed. I was willing to believe that, for my own sake. It was easy not to ask the question. "You'll be out of here soon, Ben. Can you believe it? You'll be out of prison." This was by no means a sure thing. A strip of blood on a dead girl's sheets is good, but a confession's better. Still, I was hopeful. Still. "I wouldn't mind that," he said. "It may be time. I think 24 years may be enough. It may be enough for standing by, letting it happen."
"I think so."
Lyle and I had put pieces together of that night from what Deandra had told me. They were at the house, ready to run away, and something happened that unraveled Deandra. She killed Michelle. Ben didn't stop her. My guess is Michelle somehow learned of the pregnancy, the secret baby. I would ask Ben one day, ask for the details, but I knew he'd give me nothing now. The 2 days sat looking at each other, thinking things and swallowing them. Ben scratched a pimple on his arm, the Y of the poly tattoo peeking out from his sleeve.
"So, Crystal, what can you tell me about Crystal, Libby? What happened that night? I've heard different versions. Is she wrong? Bad?"
So now it was Ben wondering what happened in a lonely, cold house outside of town. I fingered the 2 tear-shaped scars on my cheekbone, imprints from the iron steam ducts. "She's smart enough to duck the police all this time," I said. "Deandra will never say where she is."
"That's not what I asked."
"I don't know, Ben. She was protecting her mother. Deandra said she told Crystal everything, and I think she meant it.
Everything. I killed Michelle, and no one can know.
What does it do to a girl who knows her mother is a murderer? She gets obsessed. She tries to make sense of it. She clips photos of her dead relatives. She reads her dead aunt's diary until she can quote from it. She knows every angle. She spends her life ready to defend her mom. And then I show up, and it's Crystal who blows it. And what does she do? She tries to fix it. I kind of understand. I give her a pass. She won't go to prison because of me." I'd been vague with the police about Crystal. They wanted to speak with her about the fire, but they didn't know she'd tried to kill me. I wasn't going to snitch on another member of my family. I just wasn't, even if this one happened to be guilty. I tried to tell myself she wasn't that disturbed. It could have been momentary madness, born out of love. But then her mom had had a case of that, and it left my sister dead. I hope to never see Crystal again, but if I do, I'm glad I have a gun. Let's put it that way.
"You really give her a pass?"
"I know a little bit about trying to do the right thing and fucking up completely," I added.
"You talking about Mom?"
Ben said. "I was talking about me."
"You could have been talking about all of us."
Ben pressed his hand against the glass, and my brother and I matched palms.
Ben Day. Now. Standing out in the prison yard the other day, he smelled smoke. Smoke was floating on a current of air about 8 feet above his head, and he pictured the field fires of autumn, back when he was a kid, flames marching across the soil in flickering lines, burning away what's not useful. He'd hated being a farm kid, but now that's all he thought about. Outside. At night, when the other men were making their sticky sounds, he'd close his eyes and see acres of sorghum, rattling at his knees with those shiny brown beads like a girl's jewelry. He'd see the Flint Hills of Kansas, with their eerie flattened tops, like each mound was waiting for its own coyote to howl from it. Or he'd close his eyes and picture his foot, slopped deep in mud, the feel of the earth sucking him in, holding on to him. Once or twice a week, Ben had a giddy moment where he almost laughed. He was in prison. For life. For murdering his family. Could that be right? By now he thought of Ben, 15-year-old Ben, almost as his son. An entirely different being, and sometimes he wanted to throttle the kid. The kid who just didn't have it in him. He'd picture shaking Ben until his face blurred. But sometimes he was proud. Yes, he'd been a whimpering little worthless coward that night, a boy who just let things happen. Scared. But after the murders, something fell in place, maybe. He would be quiet to save Deandra, his woman, and the baby. His second family. He couldn't bring himself to bust out of that room and save Debbie and his mom. He couldn't bring himself to stop Deandra and save Michelle. He couldn't bring himself to do anything but shut up and take it. Stay still and take it. That he could do. He'd be that kind of man. He'd become famous because he was that kind of man. First he was the badass devil daddy, everyone twitching to get away from him, even the guards spooked. And then he was the kindly, misunderstood prisoner. Women came all the time, and he tried not to say too much, let them imagine what he was thinking. They usually imagined he was thinking good thoughts. Sometimes he was. And sometimes he was thinking of what would have happened if that night went different. He and Deandra and a squealing baby somewhere in western Kansas. Deandra crying mean tears in some tiny, food-grimed cell of a motel room they rented by the week. He'd have killed her. At some point, he might have. Or maybe he'd have grabbed the baby and run, and he and Crystal would be happy somewhere, her a college graduate, him running the farm, the coffee maker always on, like home. Now maybe it was his turn to be out, and Deandra's turn to be in. And he'd get out and find Crystal wherever she was. She was a sheltered kid. She couldn't disappear for long. He'd find her and take care of her. It'd be nice to take care of her. To actually do something besides shutting up and taking it. But even as he was thinking this, he knew he'd have to aim smaller. That's what he learned from his life so far. Always aim smaller. He was born to be lonely. That's what he knew for certain. When he was a kid, when he was a teenager, and definitely now. Sometimes he felt like he'd been gone his whole life, in exile, away from the place he was supposed to be, and that, soldier-like, he was pining to be returned, homesick for a place he'd never been. If he got out, he'd go to Libby, maybe. Libby, who looked like his mother, who looked like him, who had all those rhythms that he just knew, no question knew. He could spend the rest of his life begging forgiveness from Libby, looking out for Libby, his little sister, somewhere on the outside, somewhere small. That's all he wanted.
Libby Day, now. The curlicues of the prison barbed wire were glowing yellow as I reached my car, and I was busy thinking of all the people that had been harmed, intentionally, accidentally, deservedly, unfairly, slightly, completely. My mom, Michelle, Debbie, Ben, me, Chrissy Cates, her parents, Deandra's parents, Diane, tray, crystal. I wondered how much of it could be fixed, if anyone could be healed or even comforted. I stopped at a gas station to get directions because I'd forgotten how to get to Diane's mobile park, and goddammit, I was going to see Diane. I finger-brushed my hair in the station's bathroom mirror and applied some chapstick I'd almost stolen and bought instead, still not feeling entirely good about that decision. Then I drove across town into the white picket-fenced trailer park where Diane lived, daffodils yellowing up everywhere. There is such a thing as a pretty trailer park, you know. Diane's home was right where I remembered, and I rolled to a stop, giving her three honks, her ritual when she visited us way back when. She was in her small yard, poking around the tulips, her broad rear to me, a big block of woman with wavy steel hair. She turned around at my honks, blinked wildly as I got out of the car. "Aunt Diane?" I said. She strode across the yard in big, solid steps, her face tight. When she was right on top of me, she grabbed me and hugged me with such force it pushed the air out of my lungs. Then she patted me hard, twice, held me at arm's length, then pulled me in again. "I knew you could do it. I knew you could, Livy," she mumbled into my hair, warm and smoky.
"Do what?"
"Try just a little harder." I stayed at Diane's for 2 hours, till we started running out of things to say, like we always did. She hugged me again, gruffly, and ordered me to come back out on Saturday. She needed help installing a countertop. I didn't get straight on the highway, but slowly rolled toward where our farm had once been, trying to find myself there by accident. It had been a shaky spring, but now I rolled the windows down. I came to the end of the long stretch of road that would lead to the farm, bracing myself for housing developments or strip malls. Instead, I came upon an old tin mailbox, the Mueller's in cursive paint on the side. Our farm was a farm again. A man was walking the fields. Far down by the pond, a woman and a girl watched a dog splatter in the water, the girl windmilling her arms around her waist, bored. I studied it all for a few minutes, keeping my brain steady, staying away from dark place. No screams, no shotguns, no wild blue jay cries. Just listen to the quiet. The man finally noticed me and gave a wave. I waved back, but pulled away as he started to wander over, neighbor-like. I didn't want to meet him, and I didn't want to introduce myself. I just wanted to be some woman, heading back home to over there that way. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Dark Places by Gillian Flynn. Read by Rebecca Lohman, Cassandra Campbell, Mark Deakins, and Robertson Dean. This program was directed by Cassandra Campbell. Executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2009 by Gillian Flynn. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.